chapter of Helaman now, and it's one of those epic chapters. It's like the 46th and others. If this was all we had of the Book of Mormon, it would be enough to attest its authenticity right down to the ground. This is a chapter on crime. It starts out happily, and then suddenly things go sour. You notice we start out when they broke down all trade barriers and other barriers between them, they begin to prosper greatly, and they'd go wherever parts of the land they would. This is the sixth chapter, and the Lamanites could go where they went, and the free intercourse to buy and to sell and get gain according to their desire. They became exceedingly rich, Nephites and Lamanites alike, plenty of gold and silver. The land north called Mulek, the Lord brought Mulek into the land, and so forth. It's an almost gaudy civilization, isn't it? Here's a very recent geographic. You can always pick this stuff up in anything. Now, here's a typical marketplace, and it notes here, of course, this is the time of the conquistadors. This is much later. But these lavish wealth around here, as it says here, Cortez reports a crowd of 60,000 bartering for goods in one market. Now, that's business, you see. Turkeys, armadillos, rabbits, cotton bowls, girds, bolts of finest cloth, quills filled with gold dust. Notice it talks about the weaving and the gold here. Filled with gold, straw mats, corn, pottery, feathers for lavish ornament. When disputes arose, they were settled by a judge who sits under the awning here. And dress identifies region or occupation, and here's a high-ranked warrior appearing all dolled up, fit to kill, and so forth. Well, and here's another one. The buildings, the magnificent ceremonial centers they set up, places like this, you know. This is the sort of thing that Ammon and Amulek preached in. Tremendous things built by the labor, of course, of the people who were oppressed that came and listened to them and so forth. Hmm? Oh, this issue is quite... it's December 1980. It's just happened to have it by chance. But, you know, you can pick up illustrations of that lavish civilization. In other words, the Book of Mormon isn't exaggerating. It's not Joseph Smith letting his imagination run wild, as some people have said. Mr. Brody, for example. The curious workmanship. Thus they did become rich and did raise grain and multiply strong in the land with their flocks and herds, strong agriculture, pastoral. The women did toil and spin and make all manner of cloth. They're trading their cloth here. Among the Navajos, for example, only the women can spin it under some tribes. The Hopis are rare because only the men make the cloth there, but the women make the pottery, so it goes. But you get those cultural notes all through the Book of Mormon. They had great joy and peace and much preaching and many prophecies. Well, everything is happy here. A good brotherhood and all the rest of it. And then something happens. In the 15th chapter, things start going south. What is going on here? Well, obviously there's an underground, but what is it? The chief judge, Cizorim, was murdered by an unknown hand as he sat upon the judgment seat. And his son was murdered also. It sounds like the judges in Medea, in Colombia today. The judge murdering goes right on. Well, they say there must be something going on here. And the people began to grow exceedingly, all of a sudden, I mean almost overnight, they're growing exceedingly wicked. Why is that? Well, the next verse explains it again, how quickly we run into these things, say, in a post-war boom or something like that. Notice the perils of peace. Nature takes its course right into prime time today, and so we get this. The Lord had blessed them so long with the riches of the world, they had not been stirred to anger or to wars, and this is how it happened. They began to set their hearts on riches. They began to seek to get gain, that they might be lifted up one of them. Well, why does it have to be that way? We notice it always doesn't. Well, that's the way it works. That's the only way you measure your wealth is compared to with someone else. Therefore, they began to commit secret murders and to rob and plunder that they might get gain. Anything to get it. Notice you're right here on prime time in the 17th. They rob, they murder, they plunder because they go to the four things Nephi talks about. The high living, the wealth, the display, the glitzy clubs and so forth. The crime that goes right together with it. And the power. Of course, power is the whole thing. And, as I say, the luxurious living. These things that make up the ever-popular stock of our evening TV program today, we call the prime time. Now, it becomes systematized now. The cooperative action is the most effective we see here. There is a corporation formed, and it attracts members, and because of that, they can do as they jolly well please, as we learn in the 19th verse. The crime ring is exposed, a mixed Mulekite, Nephite, Lamanite operation here. All of them were mixed in on it, as we learn in the 9th verse as well. And so, Satan did stir up the hearts of the more part of the Nephites. Most of the parts, Nephites united with those bands and robbers, enter into their covenants and their oaths. The whole nation seems to become one big conspiracy here. preserve one another in whatsoever difficult circumstances they should be placed, that they should not suffer for their murders and their plunderings and their stealing. You see? This is the other brotherhood. Notice they're entering into covenants, and recently they're in another kind of covenant entirely. So we say, have they lost their heads or something? Well, a few comments here may be in order. Today, here's what I wrote this morning. Crime covers the earth, as the Book of Mormon says, like the miasmic vapor of smoke the Book of Mormon talks about that will cover the whole earth. And that miasmic vapor of crime covers the earth from pole to pole, whether it's the Valdez or whether it's the equatorial forest or whatever it is. Great various degrees of crime. That incidentally, that mist, that vapor of smoke, hangs over the earth as the last phase of extermination. We create the garbage, which is the main thing we create today. It is the main thing we create is garbage today, can you show? How do we get rid of that? Well, the ultimate thing is to burn it, and so that's the end of this smoke that hangs over the earth. Well, but crime is everywhere. Now, this is possible because of degrees of crime. Little crimes, big crimes, you have them. The Egyptians have many words for crime. They can say yisfet, wrongdoing, mischief, or they can say awat, crimes of greed, or they can say jew, which is vicious crimes. Jew is evil intent, rancorous crimes. There are selat, crimes of rebellion against whom, refusing to go a certain way, and so forth. And so this long list in the 125th section, the famous 125th section of the Book of the Dead, lists 42 basic crimes. There are 42 basic crimes. 42 is a sacred number with the Egyptians, and you get that very clearly, and of course, in the Book of Ether. We'll see how 42 figures all through the Book of Ether. But 42 is the number of crimes, just as it's the number of virtues. But that's far from a complete number. As King Benjamin tells us in his talk to the Nephites, remember, he says, I cannot number the ways in which crime may be committed. I just have to tell you the few things you can do that are right. But he actually says, remember, that he cannot enumerate all the ways that a person can sin. You can go make an impressive list, can't you, as far as that goes. Even the Jesuits failed to exhaust the list. Their probabilism, they exhaust Molina and others, try to make complete lists of crime for the purpose of Spanish Inquisition and so forth. What kind of punishment would give such kind of, what kind of crimes? And of course, when you confess, then you must be given absolution after you've made certain recompense, and how great is the crime, and how many Ave Marias do you have to say, and so forth. So they have it figured out to the fourth and fifth decimal place, how much a crime is a crime. But of course, that's a complete waste of time, because all crimes are the same as far as that thing. We say they're little crimes and big crimes, but it's one thing that makes them all crimes. What is it? Crime is anything that disfigures the true image of things. The two oldest writings in existence, perhaps the two oldest, they both claim it, the Shabako stone from Egypt and the Sefer Yetzirah of the Hebrews and Jews, usually attributed to Abraham, they both tell the same thing. Namely, we all have seven receptors. We have seven gates of knowledge by which information reaches us from the outside world. We get our, see, which is the anthropic theory. We get our ideas of the outside world, of course, through the two openings, the seven openings in the head. The two eyes, the two nostrils, the mouth, and the two ears. That makes the seven gates of knowledge, seven gates of wisdom, of perception. But we have only one projector, and that's the mouth. The word is the only way we can project what we've got in. Now, it's analyzed in both, especially in the Shabako stone. When we get these impressions, they pass through the brain, we get certain images, they're made, they go down to the heart, and we're given certain estimates and place. It's just like the left and right side of the brain. You see, the right side works on it one way, the left side in another way, the right side coordinates things, and so you get your image, and then it's brought to the heart, and then it comes up to the tongue, and the word is what your image of the world is. And that's what you project. That's the world you live in. They tell us that, these seven gateways, the receptors, but only one. And that's why the word is so important. If you foul up the word, if you make it wrong or foul, you can spoil everything, destroy everything. That's why it can be made so subtle, because you have to be taken on trust. That's the only way of conveying what you have in mind, is through the word. Their body language, I suppose, that sort of thing. Fake that. So you must trust my word implicitly if we are to communicate, because that's the only access we have to the world I live in, you see. We have to agree on things, though. So to communicate, We must, like Jacob and Laban, we meet on a common ground. See, Jacob and Laban agreed to meet at dawn at a place where a stream flowed, where there was a stone circle and one line through the center, one on one side, one on the other side, to settle their affair. That's a very ancient way, the archaic way that happened throughout the ancient world. And that's, we find that in Genesis. And so we must meet on a common ground like that. It's called a Maidan. The ancients called it a Maidan, a fair field. It is basic in chivalry. We have to meet on a fair field where we have an equal chance, you see. You can't move the goalpost every time you feel like it. That way there's no game. That's the same way if you deceive when you speak, you see. There's no game at all. If what you're telling me isn't true and you know it isn't, how am I to know if it's true or not? See, you can't move the goalpost anytime you want, but that's what we do all the time. Everybody's doing it today. It's the thing. We are taught to do it. We give courses on strategies of salesmanship. Well, strategy is defined as deception practiced on an enemy. It is deception. That's the way you win wars, by strategy, by making the enemy think what you want him to think, which is wrong. Deceive him as to your position, as to your strength, as to your intentions, as to everything about you. You must deceive the enemy to be effective for effective strategy, and it's strategy that wins battles and wars. Tactics, battle, strategy wins wars. And so we have strategies of salesmen, how to beguile people into buying things they don't want and so on, how to bamboozle them. What is your relationship with another person when you're trying to get around him that way? It breaks down all confidence, it breaks down all faith. The whole structure of society is undermined and begins to rot and corrode in that case. Well, so we have a Maidan affair field. And if I'm using that trysting place where we meet, trysting means a place of trust, to set up an ambush and entrap you when we meet there, you see, which is what most salesmen say, what nearly all public relations is. That's what we do now. We scheme those things. We have, it's one of the biggest businesses we have, of course, is public relations, is faking things, is making believes, the unreal. And so what I'm doing is destroying our universe of discourse, as they call it, you see. This is the anthropic principle that the physicists talk about today, scientists, the quantum physicists talk about so much. That is, the ultimate crime is deliberately distort and smashing our very sphere of existence, you see, our common sphere of existence. Because I've deceived you, I don't know whether I can trust you or not. So in the end, there are degrees of crime. But there are no degrees of crime. No, there are no. There's a degree of offense, say, a musician. A mediocre musician is not better than a bad musician. A mediocre musician is a bad musician. A mediocre dancer, a mediocre artist, a mediocre actor, it's excruciating. Say you have a guy who gives a violin recital and he's just a little bit off most of the time. Well, that's horrifying. That gives you goose flesh. It makes you want to scream. That's just as bad as if he was completely off on every note. See, there are no degrees here. You distort it, it's distorted, and that's that. And little distortions can be the most deceptive and the most ruinous, as far as that goes. So I say, a mediocre teacher, like myself, is a bad teacher. You see, he's not just mediocre. If he's mediocre, he's wasting students' time and his time, and he's bad. And good ones are, well, let me know when you find one. So the most violent crime, for example, and the most timid crime commit the same outrage. They rend and distort the structure of things, tear everything apart. When I lose my temper and do something really violent to somebody, that's broken down the faith and trust that exists in society. But white-collar crime is worse, because there you don't have at least the courage to break into the bank and run a risk at night. There you are deceiving friends who trust you. In white-collar crime, these are people who trust you, and you're robbing from them. That's far worse, I think, than white-collar crime, knocking somebody over the head, taking it. Not that we should practice either one, I'm not recommending. But they're equally bad, believe me. So we live and move and have our being in a world of great and small crimes and great and petty deceptions. But now the question Book of Mormon brings up here, and this is the important one. Is there a center? Is there a nucleus? Is there a fountainhead? Is there a source? Is there a director to this operation? Is it a single operation that goes on? It's like, we had talked about the Battle of the Bulge, what they call the Operation Wachtum Rhein. Their business was deception, and they succeeded entirely. The whole thing was deception. What they did, they dressed whole units in American uniforms and sent them behind the lines circulating back there and so forth. That's why I didn't have to stay at Bastogne. I was greatly, it helped my nerves. But I was immediately whisked off to Paris and reassigned back to the same front, because I knew French and German, and they were dropping these spies everywhere in uniforms to confuse the picture, you see. What was the operation? Was Operation Wachtum Rhein a number of little separate operations, or was it one big operation? When we see people lying and deceiving and tricking everywhere, is that little individual weaknesses here and there? Very well is. But is there any coordination? Is it part of one big operation? Is this run by Satan? Is there a Satan in charge of things here? Any operation, to be most effective, you see, must be organized, coordinated, centralized, systematized. In other words, it must be managed. Now, here we have this, an example of this. And this is why you have these brotherheads. Notice, man, as we talk about the oaths and covenants that go with it. They're a vital and organic part of crime. You'll always find these oaths and covenants because there has to be trust among criminals. To be more effective in your crime, you must organize to organize. You, as I've said before, one criminal can't trust another unless he takes the most terrible oaths and unless he must pay the most terrible penalty. So this is what happened. So I'm going to read some texts here that are very interesting. First is the Alarish text. Here's a picture of it. This is found in 1894, I think, on the boundary between... This is a big so. It's a shrine, basalt, very hard rock, and it was found almost at Alarish or Ismailia on the boundary line between Egypt and Palestine. It goes back to a very early time. It goes back at least 4,000 years old, but it reports events much older. Okay. And this is the Alarish that was found at Alarish. What do they call it here? Well, it says the Shrine of Ismailia, but it's called the Alarish text. And this, so I'm going to read you something from it. And this is the text here. I have one Xerox here, another one here. It's been edited by Goyon. I have a real cold now. An excuse. I should recite that epic from Palm Springs, but I won't. So let's see what he says here. It starts out, this is the situation. Now remember, this is the oldest account, and this is a story of crime. It's very old, you see. It's the oldest one we have. Yistref went on him and Shu. There was a time when Shu, that is the highest, the Shu, reigned as the king, Nuset Nefer, as the perfect king, as the absolute king. He reigned over both heaven and earth and the seas and the underworlds and all things and the Wedgeware and the great seas. He ruled all things by righteous law. Netwered. Netwered is a thing, is a law, is a law or a principle that has to be followed. He ruled all things on just proof. upon his throne, which was the throne of his father, and which was the throne of his father. See, so Shu is reigning on the throne of his father. This is in the pre-existence, and he reigned over all things at a time when everything. This is your golden age. See, all people have this golden age idea. And the father Horus Reharachti Machero, justified of word. Yisrafim, and then there came later Hemef. He wanted to establish on earth an equivalent to his palace in heaven, in the heavenly order of things, because heaven is designed, laid out on with geometrical perfection and so forth, representing all the laws of truth as men understand them. So that's what he's going to do, and he wanted to build it at the White Wall. Well, now that goes back to the very first time Egypt was settled, you see, when the White Wall was set up. Jijin Hemen, that's your... Well, then, the majesty of the gods said to the council of the gods, to the great council of the gods, which was obedient to him or following to him, that they should hold an assembly and discuss the creation of something parallel on the new earth. He said to them, let us go down. This Yima Yishem Shem En. Let us go down, we will go down, is what he says, and create there upon the earth an order like unto that which we have in heaven, he tells them that, in the east part of the earth, in the garden eastward, you see. And then it's a ritual complex, and it's described here by drawing, it's where the old stone circle used to be, there's a picture of the stone circle, as a matter of fact, and then a tree and a grove, the sacred grove, and it's called the Iyat and Bes. Iyat is a sacred gathering place, and then Bes is initiation. Bes is initiation of initiation. And the sacred grove is there. And they saw it, and they behold, and they saw it was good, and so forth, in the realms of light. And when it was completed, they said, you're in Werish, let us go down there and have a great conference and a celebration to celebrate its founding upon earth, the order as things as they are in heaven. Aha, and you're in sin. Then they all did as God had commanded, didn't ask them to. It says, as was commanded by the lordship of his majesty. So they all went down to celebrate because they had the order on earth. Then what happened, you see there? They had the shrine, and they describe it here, and the way it's laid out. Then what happens? Satan breaks in here. Here, the lake and the road and the procession. Yeah. Yeah. The two hosts of Ray in heaven. He completes part of the complex, and then it's the abbot. And where did he break in here? He comes in. They're already defending themselves. Well, it describes how Set, who is Satan here, he wants to spoil the whole thing. He comes in and wants to be made the head of everything. Of course he does. And he comes in and they start him walking down. He brings his sacred band with him. He has those that have sworn fealty to him. He has a third of the host of heaven, sort of thing. They follow him. They come down the sacred way, which leads to this holy place. And incidentally, it says, after they'd finished the plan of everything, it said, this plan shall be consulted in times of crisis or of troubles of that kind. And then there was the lake and the road for the procession, and then here, and then they brought the earthly heaven to the Mount of Shu, which is the temple, which is the place of initiation on earth, where men learn the things of heaven down here below. But then we're trying to find out where Satan breaks in on the scene here. The plan, the things that taught there were secret, and he talks about the ordinances, the Wapudi here, the completion of the temple. It is all on the heavenly model and is the seat of universal government. Then, aha, here's a new section begins here. Then Satan and his host. Yis griff shemus api. Then it happened that the children of Apep, the children of Apes, the Sebtu, those who had rebelled against the plan, Sebau was to rebel. They were the rebellious followers of, he calls them the children, the rebellious followers of Apep came. And they entered into the garden at dusk when it was dark, and darkness fell upon the earth as they came in. They came Wechowi, it says here. Just as Homer says, remember when Apollo Kai Elfen Nukti Eoikus, and his coming was like the coming of night when he came to slay and to bring the plague and so forth. And he destroys everything. Now, it says the children of light were living on the mountains here, and they invade from the plains. This is the story of the Sethians and the Cainites, which you mentioned presently anyway. But it says here in the next section that the hosts of Re and Shu remained in the mountains, and where God still ruled them, as in Zion of old, Zion upon the hills and upon the mountains, remember, where Enoch preached. And it was in the pre-existent time when Re was in the garden on earth, and it was defended by a great wall this time. They couldn't get in here. And the gods were all elevated above all these things, but then Satan gets his hold, and he really raises a rumpus. Here's the word it used, very interesting here. It says, Wedjochem and Ra, then the majesty of Re went forth, Yemef, Heri, to meet head-on in conflict, Heri, a word Herian, the word war is the same word where, Henag, Mesi, Apep, the combination, the secret combination, the brotherhood. Mesi means those who have been joined to him in his family, those who have been intimate with him, those who have sworn their oaths and so forth. So Satan and his army and the Lord's clash here, and it was at this holy place that they clash, or what turns out here. Well, then this is the shoe takes place. There's no more resistance. Shu is the sole victor. He sets up a tent shrine in defiance of the opposition. But then there's more trouble. Then he strikes again. There's one session that says he never repents, he never changes, he'll always be there. Well, this is one old text. The idea, you see, that you have organized crime going on at a very early time. And along with that, there is a there is the victory over Seth. Oh, with this goes the... I just happen to have a couple of pages of the... in hieratic here of the salt papyrus, 2825A. Deals with the same thing in the beginning. But this deals with the terrible times, the time of the flood. It talks about the... Even the gods sat with their hands upon their heads mourning, and all the children of earth were in turmoil. And it talks about the flood and the terrible things that happened at that time because of the wickedness of men. But that's another very old one, been republished by Dershane recently. But this one is a good one. It is the victory over Seth. There are many manuscripts of this, some of them very old, and this describes the same event, and... But it says in the title here, at the beginning here, it says, this ceremony of the overthrowing of Sutech, Satan, Henag Semueth, along with his followers, along with his devoted clan. Shemsu, Semu, is one who follows you wherever you go. He's an attendant. He's a regular sworn attendant, defender, and so forth. So he has his brotherhood here. This is the celebration, the netag is a ceremony of the overthrowing of Sutef and his faithful band. This is performed in the temple of Osiris of Amenti and so forth, the great god, the lord of Abydos, and it's to be performed daily in a small, reduced fashion in every temple in Egypt at a particular hour. Heret, Heri, En, Hero, En, Heroneb. Mitet, even as it's performed here, but in the reduced form of Mitet, Em, Pero, Nebet, in every temple of Egypt. So this is the basic ordinance, temple ordinance of Egypt, and it begins with the fall and with Satan's interruption in things. And it describes, this is a certain ritual dress and so forth described first, and then things get down. Page 7, but I'd used it in some other context, like misplaced. I have to begin on page 9 here, which is just as good, I guess, because it describes what's going on, the terrible indictment. Now it says, Odit Hebenuech, Embe, thou hast performed, and it's written like the Bible in parallel passages. A passage is written, then it's repeated. The word of the Lord in Jerusalem. So if it repeats the word, in other words, it says here, Yert hebenet ek em bech ra. Thou hast performed violent acts, crimes. Heaven is a crime. Thou hast performed, that's what it's described in the Shabbat. Thou hast committed crimes in the presence of God. And then, wechem tu ek, and the mischief thou hast done has been reported to the Most High God. That way. And the Pesachat and the Great Council is Herr Dieter Erheres has taken it under consideration. If Satan is done. Ya Herr Wedgmedu, and Thoth Jehuti, he is the secretary in heaven, and he's the third member of the Godhead here, has taken due note of it and has made a list of all offenses. He has drawn up the list of indictments for the court. Wedge Medu is to make, there's a picture of a wedge, of a slicing rack, and then a picture of a staff. Medu has arranged to make the decision, make the judgment, has set up the indictments, and so forth. They're aware of what you've done, they bring these charges against you, and so forth, and your ultimate condemnation will be the fire. The earth complains that it has been violated, as it does in the book the book of Moses, of course. The world has rebelled. Men are in a terrible state here. And then it says, Geb, who is Adam, our literal father, the principle of patriarchal succession is Geb. He organizes the human family. He is the first father on earth, you see. He shoe above, but our first father, Geb, down here below. And he, Medu, FN, and he addresses the council of the gods. He asks why these things come forth before us. Petersel Acha, who is raising all this warfare among the children of men? Ta Henen Yemusen. The earth is in turmoil, the earth is in uproar. Henen means completely disturbed, completely disorganized because of them and so forth. And so they have the session, but again, he has it well organized. It is Sutech, the same one again, and he is incurable. tells us a little later on, he comes back again and again, and he always turns out to be the same. He destroys the temple. Now here's what happens. He says he with his hosts of Rishi has gained control of everything. They're cutting down all the trees. It says they're hunting and fishing everything away. It was a time of extermination again. The temple, they barge into the annex. They disrupt everything with loud, raucous voices. They raise a rumpus everywhere. Again, they talk about the lumber business, which is offensive because they have been taking logs out of reserved forests. And of course, they were very precious in Egypt to have them. They defile the temples with their false ordinances and dances and so forth. It's the archaic temple, and he says, you've renewed the fighting. And then the taboos and abominations. They trespass in the holy places. That's it all the time, the way they come. And they practice piracy. They loot everything they go. Every seat they come into. Wait a minute. Awa, that means plunder. That's Awa anef hetepet. They plunder all the peaceful places. And plunder Philae and so forth. And it talks about the fruit of Eden. They're bandits, in other words. He's the lord of misrule. He rules with blood and horror, it says here. Neka, Sha'o. Er set an F. Upon his throne there is he scorns civilization, it said. He's a lord of misrule. And then Sophia enters into, well, here we again, you see, and he's very well organized. Here we give the genealogy of Adam and so forth. It goes back to man by the name of Adam. And the bees in the marshes. Well, these oldest accounts then are of somebody who rebelled and raised hell and organized it and had his band following him, and we've been ritually fighting him every day. You see, that's what they do here. And then the Scythians and the Canaanites, of course, in the oldest books of Adam and so forth. A rich literature has come forth recently. The Scythians, after the children of Adam divided, the Scythians lived on the mountains. There were very few of them. After the people had gone out down into the plains and caroused and founded Babylon, become luxurious and so forth, and Nimrod had built the tower and all these things. And remember, the Book of Mormon is going to tell us all this. It goes back to the tower and the light. But there had always been these secret conjurations and the two brotherhoods, each claiming to be the righteous. The most famous perhaps are the Pythagoreans, you see. How do you tell the difference? Each accuses the other of one evil. You'll find from now on there are large societies worldwide, usually suspected of being worldwide, of these brotherhoods. There's both good and evil ones, but the evil ones, and they're always accusing each other of just one crime, world domination. They're after world domination. Now, the Pythagoreans, you know, were very lofty thinkers, but their oaths and their covenants, which came from Egypt, were secret, and they took sides unwisely in certain political things, and some popular uprisings burned them out and destroyed their order, but they were of great influence, and they still are. They carry on, of course, in other orders after that. Now, you have the ICX in Rome, in early Republican Rome, before the Empire. They passed a law forbidding the cult of Isis to come from Egypt, to practice in Egypt, because they thought it was a crime against the a world. They thought it was seeking world domination, a crime against the Empire. They had an empire then, though it wasn't the Imperium, they didn't have a ruler. And so you have the Sicarii. Do you know what these secret, these death squads call themselves in Colombia? They call themselves Sicario. The Sicarii were Roman. In Varro, which was written before Augustus' day, Varro's great work on agriculture, you have a story of the richest men in Rome have met in the poor, where there's a map of the world, map of Italy, a big map of Italy on the wall there, and they're discussing where their estates were and boasting about their wealth and so forth. They're waiting for one man who's exceedingly rich and influential. The Sicarii. And the same thing as Semitic languages, anyway. And finally his servant comes and says, sorry, his master won't be able to come to the meeting because he was just murdered by one Sicarii. Somebody slipped out of the crowd. A Sicarii is a little knife, a short knife. You carry it under your robe, and you just slip through the crowd, assassinate somebody, and you're on your way. And these people in Colombia still call themselves Sicarios. Their organization is Sicaria. But that was happening. As he departed, however, he made a mistake. He apologized as he slipped away, said, I'm sorry, I've killed the wrong man, and disappeared in the crowd. But the most powerful man in Rome was unable to defend himself against these terrorists. And they're just operating. This was in the flower of Rome, in the noblest period of their existence. And so we get the Mediterranean pirates, and that's how Pompey got to power, the triumvirate. The big fire was who should eliminate the Mediterranean pirates. By this time, by the time Augustus became emperor, the first emperor, the whole Mediterranean was terrified by various bands of pirates. And they were brotherhoods, they were sacred, and plays about them and so forth. So these pirates are very dangerous people. And we've mentioned about the Vitalians and the Vitalian brethren and the Vikings, your ancestors, and all these people that go around plundering on the seas, and the great influence they had, and the Jomsburg, which is a very sacred order. And then you have Hadrian's Rescript. Why did they persecute this Christian? The Christians, they thought, because they announced that the Lord would come and rule over the earth, that that was their plan. And they met in secret. They had certain ordinances which the world didn't know. And we have a famous Rescript written to the Emperor Hadrian, which would make it before the year 138, telling about the Christians in Asia Minor. And are they dangerous? Are they a danger to the empire? That's why Nero and others persecuted them. And but the very same thing, DeWitt Talmage, the most influential preacher in America, in the late 19th century. His big theme, the only thing he ever talked about, was that the Mormons threaten world dominion. That's what they're after. Well, because we say, you see, the Lord's going to come and rule and so forth. They're right that way. The world can't go on the way it is. But always these countercharges are made. So in Hadrian's Rescript, you find the same thing. You see that the Christians, they should be exterminated because they're a threat to the empire, our world empire. We're the world empire. And then the last people to hold their own were the Jews, as you know, and this was just before that. And they were the Zealots. The Zealots were secretly organized, and they went around murdering. They're like a Stern gang today. And then you come down to the Middle Ages, you have the Assassins. And again, they could spread their influence to China and to England. As far as that goes, the Assassins was organized in the year 1090, just 5 years before the other crowd organized themselves against it in the Crusades and organized the Templars and the Knights Templar and the Knights of the Hospitallers and so forth. But the Assassins, oh yes, we're talking about them. Here was a man called Hassan ibn Sabah, who founded the Assassins. Hashish is hemp. It's a drug, you know, that makes you wild. And he had this castle at Malamut. You always have a center, and that was the great center at Malamut, just like the one at Jomsburg. And from there, he would send out these kids, and they were all hopped up, and they'd commit, assassinations. And they were promised heaven if they did it, and because they were drugged when they did, as far as that goes, they would go out and he could terrify anyone. Everybody's scared to death of the old man. They called him the old man of the mountain. He was renowned. And there are still groups surviving in the Druze country, in Lebanon and so forth, from the Assassins. These things carry on and on and on. There are continuing traditions in the earth, and you see them now, of course, not just in there, but the answer to that is the Militant Order, you see, in 1095. Preached the great sermon at Clermont, Bernard of Clairvaux, preached the great sermon, which got the First Crusade going, and then they organized to defend people going to the temple. They organized the Templars and the Hospitallers, and these became orders, militant orders, because they each had a Red Cross on a white, the Knights of Malta, or they had a Red Cross, a black cross on a white robe, or a white cloud on a black robe, but always a cross on the shoulder. And there were the Hospitallers, and then they became very rich, very influential, and they were charged, the rumor spread that they wanted to rule the world, and this is why Philip IV of France, who was a world's prize heel, he wanted to get money from the Jews. He wanted to rule the world from Jerusalem. This is what happened. As soon as they set up in Jerusalem, they didn't hold on very long. What happened to these orders, for example, they were driven out. First, they were driven to Acre on the shore, Acre, then to Cyprus, then to Rhodes, then the Knights of Rhodes, then the Knights of Malta, then they go to France. And it's in France that Philip the Fair tries to exploit them, but only after he first wanted to exploit the Jews. He wanted, because of the Assizes of Jerusalem. Now, the Assizes of Jerusalem are a protocol for the court life and the structure of government in which some European king would rule from Jerusalem, rule the world from Jerusalem. They took that dead seriously, the Assizes of Jerusalem. And that's why you have this magnificent display, all this theatrical stuff of chivalry and so forth, all centering around Jerusalem. Abraham, the Holy Grail motif, and things like that. And that was their justification. It was sacred and it was a world group. Well, I have an article, a rather long article, in the Encyclopedia Judaic on that very subject. If you look under Christian Jerusalem in there. Jerusalem was their justification for wanting to rule the world, because from Jerusalem, the word of the Lord and so forth, the temple was Jerusalem, Jerusalem was the Holy Land was the world. That's the way they came. It went out like sparks from a central fire. So you have these hospitallers and templars moving from one place to another and getting very rich. And but in order to rule under the assizes of Jerusalem and hold the throne there, Philip IV wanted to get money from the Jews, and he had a way of doing it. He would take every Jew had to give everything he had. He had one eye knocked out, and if he wouldn't give everything, then he had the other eye knocked out. So he got very rich, but he wasn't getting rich enough. And there was a rebellion against him, and he fled and was protected by the Templars, by the Knights Templars, who were in France at this time, and their great leader was Jacques de Molay. You all know de Molay, the Masonic order, the Molays, the junior Masonics. And Jacques de Molay, he was the head of the order. So what did Philip do but accuse him publicly, spread the word around and all through the clergy, that he was, that the Jesuits were, Jesuits, no, that the Templars were aspiring to world rule, that their immense wealth was going to be used to enslave the human race. They made up all these wild stories about them, above all that they practiced immoral things. These lodges were very secret, and they thought, well, terrible secret. Well, this happened also, you see, way back the reach. Anytime you do anything like in secret, they can tell all sorts of stories about it. That's what they did about the Pythagoreans. That's what they did about the Christians. These love feasts they have, when they all engage in promiscuous sex and all this. All these stories went around, and some real beauties went around about the de Molay, these people in France accused of this world conspiracy. And they were, 60,000 of them were lined up executed in the cruelest possible fashion. They fled to Scotland, becomes the Scottish Order up there. Still exists, you see. Everywhere in the world you're going to find these orders, you see, and they've always existed there. And are they the right ones or the wrong ones? And at the same time, you see, there are the Cathari in southern France, the Holy Grail, there's a book that created an immense sensation in Europe a couple of years ago. It still does, and it's called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, by Leigh and Lincoln and somebody else there. Correspondence for BBC. They got the idea together that there came from Palestine in the time of Christ certain relatives of the family of Christ and settled near Marseille, and they spread out their order descending from them. And the Holy Grail is the Sang Graal, the Holy Blood, the Sang Royal, the Royal Blood, which came down from Christ's family and which is claimed by every family in Europe. Very interesting. And all sorts of intrigues and murders and everything center around that. It's an interesting thing. The chivalric orders, the Rosicrucians. You can go on about these. Each one has been accused of, say, a world ambition, has been persecuted and so forth. And then the cleverest of all, of course, are the Jesuits. They were really after it. See, that's why the Spanish Inquisition was to go everywhere. That was their object. They established the office of the Propaganda Fidei. That's our word propaganda comes from them, for propagating the faith. They became expert liars, very clever. And then we find in our own day, we find such things, what do we find now? Well, the Anti-Mason Party in this country. Now, that was a big thing, the Anti-Mason, and it all centers right around the time and place of where Joseph Smith produced the Book of Mormon. That's an interesting thing here. It was in 1797, a French Jesuit by the name of Auguste Baruel, wrote a book, well, five volumes, which became enormously popular, in which he proved that the Freemasons were trying to take over the world. And they caused the French Revolution. They caused revolutions everywhere. And the ultimate conspiracy against royalty in all the world. The identical charges brought against communism after that. And he accused George Washington of being one of the Illuminati. The Weisskopf organized a branch of that called the Illuminati. In 1776, as a matter of fact, the Illuminati in Europe were organized. George Washington was a Mason. But there was a great excitement about it, and there was an old fraud by the name of William Morgan, who also wrote a book about it, because he was a drunk. He'd been kicked out of the Masons, and he wrote a book about it. Well, that was, nobody took it very seriously, but he turned up. He was driven away one day from Canandaigua, New York, which is very near where we find where you find the Book of Mormon convenient to the hill, to the city of Manchester, is Canandaigua. And he was whisked away in a wagon across the border to Niagara Falls, and he disappeared and was never heard of again. Well, various bodies turned up. They all claimed that this was Morgan, but they claimed that the Masons had done him in. And this was worked up to a tremendous fury about it, and Thurlow Weed was actually, famous American, was actually head of the anti-Masonic party, and it was a party, and they ran it for president, you see. Ethan Smith, Joseph Smith, had been accused of stealing from Ethan Smith for the Book of Mormon. He headed the anti-Mason representatives in Massachusetts in 1832. He accused the Illuminati. That was his big thing. But 32, that was 2 years after the Book of Mormon. You see this Ethan Smith raising a big stink after this. But it got to be a big thing. In 1 year, I was just looking it up, in 1 year, 227 lodges were closed in Massachusetts alone, and the Masonic movement practically collapsed then. And, you know, the town of Fillmore here was named because President Fillmore was Fillmore. Do you know how he got elected? He was on the anti-Mason ticket. That was his ticket. He got elected as the head of the anti-Mason party, elected President Fillmore, as well as William Henry Seward, who became Secretary of, who bought Alaska, remember, Secretary of State under Lincoln. And so these anti-Masonic candidates won everything. Well, how did the Masons ever get back? It was mostly with Andrew Jackson's return. The populism, the romantic movement, Andrew Jackson, so forth, who was a Mason, he was the chief Mason of Tennessee, and Masons came back into repute after that. They represented the popular movement against all monarchy, against all government, against all order, and so forth. That's the charge that was made against the Masons, a big thing. But the thing is that things have always been stirred, and this went over all Europe and America and everywhere else. If it isn't one thing, it's another. And what is it today? You know about the Mafia, and they're everywhere. And you know about the Triad in Hong Kong and so forth, the Tong Wars, of important leagues to disrupt everything, the Chinese Tong Wars among the Chinese families. But the Triad is extremely powerful. They can do away with any of them when they want to, you see, and they rule in places like this, Hong Kong, Singapore, whichever it is. And in Israel, it was the Stern Gang. It was the gang that got in, and what's his name? Shamir was was the head of that. What a character. And then the SS, you see, in the SS, Hitler's SS, Schutzstaffel, was organized as a society of brotherhood with secret oaths and covenants and so forth, and very bloody and the like, and they were to counteract the Jews. And you have the Shining Path today in Peru, and you have the Medellin count that every week gets rid of another judge. They have their terrorizing the country entirely. Now, the main thing is they want to keep the peasants in place. It seems, an interesting article came out yesterday that the main object is not drugs at all, but just the old claim of the landholders. They want to get back to their power. When 1% of the people, well, just a few families, just a handful of families would rule the country, that was the Central American pattern. Well, then in our inner cities, we have the Sharks and the Bloods and various inner city gangs, which are very serious. I mean, half a dozen get killed every weekend in Los Angeles, don't they? And then right around here, we have Satanism. Can't we get this out of our system? And it's a romantic theme. Remember Sax Raymer and Fu Manchu, he's going to rule the world. You see, that's the whole thing. Or Rex Stout and Mr. Zek, isn't it? And James Bond is always going after Goldfinger, somebody like that. James Bond. It always has to do with secret conjurations to rule the world. It's great power. It has to do with some individual who's got control of some atomic power or something else, and he can intimidate, he can blackmail all the nations and the like. But it always think in world terms. Oh, boy, I didn't know. Now, What's behind it all here? Now we get it here, the secret society. The Book of Mormon explains it to us. In the first place, I think we should point out this thing. Yeah. Well, that's these points. First, when we're dealing with in the Book of Mormon, I mean, the best treatise you'll find on this is this sixth chapter here and what follows. But first place, there are no isms. There are organizations, as Little Hart says. It's the individual affair, what war is. Religion and nationality are not basic. You can belong to anything you want as far as that goes. It's not the party machine. It's not the Politburo or anything like that. And then in the second, it's something else. It's personal ambitions and so forth. And secondly, it must have a power base. It must have a market. A way of robbery, piracy has been official. Right now, then it was bootlegging, things like that. Today it's drugs. It won't be for always. It used to be pearls. It was cattle stealing was the, and then gambling, as in Vegas, you can build an empire on gambling, you can build an empire on drugs, all of these things, you can build an empire on prohibition, I mean, illicit things like that. And then the third point is the object is the broadest, hence this broadest appeal. Those four things that Nephi mentions, both Nephis mention, it is for money, it is for power. The one who holds the gun has the power. It is for popularity. It must have public support. It always do. And the lust of the flesh, the glitzy club, the high-class dames, the Tony resorts and places like that. Well, these all fit into the same setting that we're all so fond of today, as you know, your TV. It must offer protection, the fourth part. They offer protection. Now, the Book of Mormon goes right into this Gadianton stuff. It breaks it all down. You'll find all these elements are there. It must offer protection. And the fifth is... it must seek an air of total respectability. The stretch limo, the overdressing, the very expensive dressing, even piety. They're good church members, these people are, like the mafia, very pious, family people, the capo, loyal to each other and so on. You have an image of ultimate respectability. They strive for that. And they have their own mystique. They're entirely independent, I say, of state and things like that. This is the picture the Book of Mormon gives. It's accurate and explicit enough to make its explanation of the whole thing quite credible as far as I'm concerned. So, isn't it funny? 3 years ago, we would have thought this was a waste of time. Maybe it's a waste of time now. But that crime should take such a... First it's war, and then it's crime in the Book of Mormon. These things that are emphasized that have made the Book of Mormon unpopular, they made it avoided. We didn't want to read about these unpleasant things, but it keeps rubbing our nose into it. And this is what it's talking about now. You read these chapters on crime, and they'll make you sick. So that's a great promise, isn't it?